At most of the claims, his overtures were met with a shrug and a turned back. But one or two of the diggers remembered him as the elephant hunter or the writer fellow, and used his visit as an excuse to lean on their shovels and talk for a few minutes. "I've got two briefies," a digger who introduced himself as Jock Danby told Zuga, "but I call them the Devil's Own. With these two hands," he held up his huge paws, the palms studded with raised calluses, the nails chipped away and black with dirt, "with my own hands I've shifted 15,000 tons of the stuff, and the biggest stone I've pulled is a 2. That there," he pointed to the adjoining claim, "was Black Thomas's claim. Yesterday he pulled out a monkey, a bloody fat stinking monkey, only 2 feet from my side peg. Christ, it's enough to break your heart." "Buy you a beer," Zuga jerked his head towards the nearest canteen, and the man licked his lips, then shook his head regretfully. "My kid is hungry. You can see the ribs sticking out of the little bugger, and I have to pay wages by noon tomorrow." He indicated the dozen half-naked black tribesmen labouring with pick and bucket in the bottom of the neatly squared-off excavation with him. "These bastards cost me a fortune every day." Jock Danby spat on his calloused palms and hefted the shovel, but Zuga cut in smoothly. "They do say the strike will pinch out at the level of the plain." At this point, the copy had been reduced to a mere 20 feet above the surrounding plain. "What do you think?" "Mister, it's bad luck to even talk like that." Jock checked the swing of his shovel and scowled heavily up at Zuga on the roadway above him, but there was fear in his eyes. "You ever thought of selling out?" Zuga asked him, and immediately Jock's fear faded to be replaced by a sly expression. "Why, mister, you thinking of buying?" Jock straightened. "Let me give you a little tip for free. Don't even think about it. Not unless you got £6,000 to do the talking for you." He peered up at Zuga hopefully, and Zuga stared back at him without expression. "Thank you for your time, sir. And for your sake, I hope the gravel lasts." Zuga touched the wide brim of his hat and sauntered away. Jock Danby watched him go, then spat viciously on the yellow ground at his feet and swung the shovel at it as though it were a mortal enemy. As he walked away, Zuga felt a strange sense of elation. There was a time when he had lived by the turn of a card and the fall of a die, and he felt the gambler's instinct now. He knew the gravel would not pinch out. He knew it sank down, pure and rich, into the depths. He knew it with a deep, unshakable certainty. And he knew something else with equal certainty. "The road to the north begins here," he spoke aloud, and felt his blood thrill in his veins. "This is where it begins." He felt the need to make an act of faith, of total affirmation, and he knew what it must be. The price of livestock on the diggings was vastly inflated, and his oxen were costing him a guinea a day to water. He knew how to close the road back. By mid-afternoon he had sold the oxen, £100 a head, and £500 for his wagon. Now he was committed, and he felt the currents of excitement coursing through his body as he paid the gold coin over the raw wooden counter of the tin shack that housed the branch of the Standard Bank. The road back was cut. He was chancing it all on the yellow gravel and the road northwards.
"Zuga, you promised," a letter whispered when the buyer came to Zuga's camp to collect the oxen. "You promised that in 1 week..." Then she fell silent when she saw his face. She knew that expression. She drew the two boys to her and held them close. Jan Sharoot went to each of the animals in turn and whispered to them as tenderly as a lover, and his stare was reproachful as he turned to Zuga while the span was led away. Neither man spoke, and at last Jan Sharoot dropped his gaze and walked away, a slight, barefooted, bow-legged little gnome. Zuga thought he had lost him, and he felt a rush of distress, for the little man was a friend, a teacher, and a companion of 12 years. It was Jan Sharoot who had tracked his first elephant, and stood shoulder to shoulder with him as he shot it down. Together they had marched and ridden the breadth of a savage continent, They had drunk from the same bottle and eaten from the same pot at 1,000 campfires. Yet he could not bring himself to call him back. He knew that Jan Sjoerd must make his own decision. He need not have worried. When dop time came that evening, Jan Sjoerd was there to hold out his chipped enamel mug. Zuga smiled, and ignoring the line that measured his daily ration of brandy, he filled the mug to the brim. "It was necessary, old friend," he said, and Jan Sjoerd nodded gravely. "They were good beasts," he said, "but then I have had many fine beasts go from my life, four-legged and two-legged ones." He tasted the raw spirit. "After a little time and a dram or two, it does not matter so much." Aletta did not speak again until the boys were asleep in the tent. "Selling the oxen and the wagon was your answer," she said. "It cost a guinea a day to water them, and the grazing has been eaten flat for miles about. There have been 3 more deaths in the camp. I counted 30 wagons leaving today. It's a plague camp." "Yes," Zuga nodded. "Some of the claim holders are getting nervous. A claim that I was offered for £1,100 yesterday was sold for £900 today. Zuga, it's not fair to me or the children," she began. But he interrupted her. "I can arrange a passage for you and the boys with a transport rider. He has sold his stock and he leaves in the next few days. He will take you back to Cape Town." They undressed in darkness and silence. And when Aletta followed him into the narrow, hard cot, the silence continued until he thought she had fallen asleep. Then he felt her hand, smooth and soft, touch his cheek lightly. "I am sorry, my darling." Her voice was as light as her touch, and her breath stirred his beard. "I was so tired and depressed." He took her hand and held the tips of her fingers to his lips. "I've been such a poor wife to you, always too sick and weak when you needed someone strong." Timidly she let her body touch his. "And now, when I should be a comfort to you, I do nothing but snivel." "No," he said, "that's not true." And yet, over the years, he had resented her often enough for just those reasons. He had felt like a man trying to run with shackles on his ankles. "And yet I love you, Zuga. I loved you the first day I laid eyes on you. And I have never ceased to love you." "I love you too, Aletta," he assured her. Yet the words came automatically. And to make up for the lack of spontaneity, he placed his arm around her shoulders, and she drew closer still and laid her cheek against his chest. "I hate myself for being so weak and sickly," she hesitated, "for not being able to be a real wife any more." "Shh, Aletta, do not upset yourself." "I will be strong now. You will see." "You have always been strong, deep inside." "No, but I will be now. We shall find that capful of diamonds together, and afterwards we shall go north." He did not reply, and it was she who spoke again. "Zuga, I want you to make love to me, now." "Aletta, you know that is dangerous." "Now," she repeated. "Now, please." And she took his hand down and placed it under the hem of her nightdress, against the smooth, warm skin of her inner thigh. She had never done that before, and Zuga found himself shocked, but strangely aroused, and afterwards he was filled with a deep tenderness and compassion for her that he had not felt for many years. When her breathing had become regular once more, she pulled his hands away gently and slipped out of the cot. Leaning on one elbow, he watched her light the candle and then kneel by the trunk that was lashed to the foot of the cot. She had plaited her hair with a ribbon in it, and her body was slim as a young girl's. The candlelight flattered her, smoothing out the lines of sickness and worry. He remembered how lovely she had been. She lifted the lid of the trunk, took something from the interior, and brought it to him. It was a small cask with an ornate brass lock. The key was in the lock. "Open it," she said. In the candlelight, he saw that the cask contained two thick rolls of 5-pound notes, each bound up with a scrap of ribbon, and a drawstring pouch of dark green velvet. He lifted out the pouch, and it was heavy with gold coin.
"I was keeping it," she whispered, "for the day it was really needed. There is almost £1,000 there."
"Where did you get this?"
"My father, on our wedding day. Take it, Zuga. Buy that claim with it. This time we will make it all right. This time is going to be all right."
In the morning, the purchaser came to claim the wagon. He waited impatiently while the family moved their meagre possessions into the bell tent. Once Zuga had removed the cots from the tented half of the wagon body, he was able to lift the planking from the narrow compartment over the rear wheel truck. Here the heavier goods were stored to keep the vehicle's centre of gravity low. The spare trek chain, the lead for moulding into bullet, axe heads, a small anvil, and then Zuga's household god, which he and Jan Sharut strained to lift from its padded bed and lower to the ground beside the wagon. Between them they carried it to the tent and set it upright against the far screen of the bell tent.
"I've lugged this rubbish from Matabeleland to Cape Town and back," complained Jan Sharut disgustedly, as he stood back from the graven bird-like figure on its stone plinth.
Zuga smiled indulgently. The Hottentot had hated that ancient idol from the very first day they discovered it together, in the overgrown ruins of an ancient walled city, a city they had stumbled on while hunting elephant in that wild, untamed land so far to the north.
"It's my good luck charm," Zuga smiled. "What luck?" Jan Sharut demanded bitterly. "Is it luck to have to sell the oxen? Is it luck to live in a tent full of flies amongst a tribe of white savages?"
Muttering and mumbling bitterly, Jan Sharut stamped out of the tent and snatched up the halters of the two remaining horses to take them down to the water. Zuga paused for a moment in front of the statue. It stood almost as high as his head on its slim column of polished green soapstone. Atop the column crouched a stylized bird figure on the edge of flight. The cruel curve of the falcon beak fascinated Zuga, and in a habitual gesture he stroked the smooth stone, and the blank eyes stared back at him inscrutably. Zuga opened his lips to whisper to the bird, and at that moment a letter stooped into the triangular opening of the tent and saw what he was doing. Quickly, almost guiltily, Zuga dropped his hand and turned to face her. Aletta hated that stone image even more bitterly than did Jan Sharut. Now she stood very still. Her arms were filled with a pile of neatly folded linen and clothing, but her eyes were troubled. "Zuga, must we have that thing in here?" "Oh, it takes up no room," he told her lightly, and came to take her burden from her, place it on the truckle bed, and then turn back to take her in his arms. "I will never forget what you did last night," he told her, and felt the rigidity go out of her body. She swayed against him and lifted her face to his. Once again he felt his chest squeezed with compassion as he saw the lines of sickness and worry at the corners of her eyes and mouth, saw the grey patina of fatigue on her skin. He bowed his head to kiss her lips, feeling awkward at such unaccustomed demonstration of affection. But at that moment the two boys burst into the tent, raucous with laughter and excitement, and dragging between them a stray puppy on a string. And a letter broke hurriedly from Zuga's embrace, and flushing with embarrassment, adjusted her apron, beginning to scold her offspring fondly. "Out with it, it's covered in fleas. Oh, please, Mama! Out, I say." She watched Zuga set off into the sprawling settlement, striding down the dusty track with his shoulders squared and the old jaunty spring in his step. Then she turned back to the cone of soiled canvas set on a bleak, dry plain under the cruel blue African sky, and she sighed. The weariness came upon her again in waves. In her girlhood, there had been servants to perform the menial tasks of cooking and cleaning. She still had not mastered the smoky, fluttering, open flames of the campfire, and already a fine red coating of dust had settled upon everything, even the surface of the goat's milk in its earthenware jug. With an enormous effort of will, she gathered her resolve and stooped determinedly into the tent. Ralph had followed Jan Schroot down to the wells to help with the horses. She knew that the two of them would not return until the next mealtime. They made an incongruous pair, the wizened little old man and the handsome, reckless child, already taller and more sturdy than his inseparable protector and tutor. Jordan stayed with her. He was not yet 10 years of age, but without his companionship, she doubted that she could have borne the terrible journey across those bone-breaking miles, the burning, dusty days and the frosty nights of aching cold. Already the child could cook the simple camp dishes, and his unleavened bread and griddle scones were family favourites every meal. She had taught him to read and write, and given to him her love of poetry and fine and beautiful things. He could already darn a torn shirt and wield the heavy, coal-filled stroking iron to smooth a shirt. His sweet piping tones and angelic beauty were constant sources of intense joy to her. She had grown his golden curls long for once, resisting her husband when he wanted to scissor them short, as he had done Rolf's. Jordan stood below her now, helping her to string a canvas screen across the tent that would divide the sleeping and living areas. She was suddenly compelled to lean down and touch those soft, fine curls. At the touch, he smiled sweetly up at her, and abruptly her senses spun dizzily. She swayed wildly on the rickety cot, trying to keep her balance, and as she fell, Jordan struggled to hold and steady her. He did not have the strength, and her weight bore them both to the ground. Jordan's eyes were huge and swimming with horror. He helped her half crawl, half stagger back to the cot and collapse upon it. Waves of heat and nausea and giddiness broke over her. Zugo was the first customer at the office of the Standard Bank when the clerk opened the door onto Market Square. Once he had deposited the contents of a letter's casket and the clerk had locked it in the big green iron safe against the far wall, Zugo had a balance of almost £2,500 to his credit. That knowledge armed his resolve. He felt tall and powerful as he strode up the ramp of the central causeway. The roadways were 7 feet wide. The mining commissioner, after the lesson of the diggings at Bultfontein and De Toispan, had insisted that these access roads be left open to service the claims in the centre of the growing pit. The workings were a mosaic of square platforms, each precisely 30 feet square. Some of the diggers, with more capital and better organisation, were sinking their claims faster than others, so that the slower workers were isolated on towers of golden yellow earth high above their neighbouring claims, while the fastest miners had sunk deep square shafts at the bottom of which toiled the naked black labourers. For a man to move from one claim to another was already a laborious and often downright dangerous journey, crossing rickety boardwalks above the dizzying shaft of a deep claim, scrambling up high swaying rope ladders or down the steps of a pole ladder, lengths of native timber lashed together with cross steps that creaked and gave with a man's weight. Standing on the crumbling roadway with the workings gaping below him, Zugo wondered what would be the outcome if the strike continued to great depth. It already required a level head and strong stomach to chance the uneven pit, and he wondered again at man's determination to accumulate wealth against any odds in the face of any danger. He watched while from the bottom of the workings a leather bucket brimming with broken lumps of the compacted yellow gravel was hauled up, swinging at the end of a long rope, two sweating black men dipping and swinging over the windlass, their muscles swelling and subsiding in the bright sunlight. The bucket reached the lip of the roadway, and they seized it, lugged it to the waiting cart with its patient pair of mules, and dumped the contents into the half-full body. Then one of them dropped the empty bucket over the side of the roadway to the waiting men 50 feet below. At hundreds of points along the 14 causeways, the same operation was being repeated. Endlessly, the loaded buckets came swinging up and were dropped back empty. Occasionally, breaking the monotonous rhythm, the seam of a leather bucket would burst, showering the men below with jagged chunks of rock or a worn rope would snap, and with warning shouts, the toilers at the bottom of the pit would hurl themselves aside to avoid the plunging missile.